we all have a responsibility to respond to abuse. And so we know it's difficult for different people thinking that maybe it's not my role or it's not my job. Yeah. But it's okay to say, and it's okay to call us if you have a suspicion or if you have a disclosure or if you've witnessed something, because we're not that reporting service and we will help you to help the older person.
And welcome to Law for Community Workers on the Go. This is a series of podcasts brought to you by Legal Aid New South Wales. In each episode, one of us from the Community Legal Education branch will be chatting to experts on different legal topics. We're really excited to have you all listening today, and we hope that you'll learn something new and interesting.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the Legal Aid New South Wales Law for Community Workers on the Go podcast. My name is Kerry Wright and I work with the Legal Aid New South Wales Community Legal Education team. I'm here today with Lee Critchley, a civil lawyer with Legal Aid, and Chris Matty, who works with the New South Wales Elder Abuse Helpline. Welcome, Lee and Chris.
Thank you.
Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land we're recording on today, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to, or our respects, to their elders past and present. Today we're going to talk about recognising and responding to the abuse of older people, in particular how you as community workers can assist with this, and what services you can access to assist you to assist an older person who may believe or know, who you may believe or know is suffering from abuse. So what I want to do to start today is to ask both you, Lee and Chris, what you find most rewarding about the work you do with older people. So Lee, do you want to start?
The most rewarding thing is being able to help the older person when they really thought that there was no one that could really help them and that they didn't think that they would be able to do anything to redress the financial abuse that they've suffered. And in my experience, the older people that have been my clients are some of the loveliest people, and they're also so sincere and appreciative of your assistance. They're really I've always had some really lovely people, and it can be quite heartbreaking what they're going through. And they've also been some pretty strong people too, that they've been able to keep going even though it's been very emotionally and financially devastating for them.
So how long have you been working with older people?
Well, probably 10 years in this job.
Right.
And before that, I was working at Senior Rights, so...
Oh, okay.
It's going back a fair way now.
So you have worked with a lot of older people in lots of different legal situations.
Yes.
But here at Legal Aid, it's mostly financial abuse.
It's financial abuse, and particularly for situations where the older person has lost their home, or in situations where they have moved in with their adult children, they've made a financial contribution, and then the relationship's broken down and the older person's been basically kicked out.
Yes.
And then those are the sorts of issues where Legal Aid definitely can step in and take some legal action on behalf of the older person. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. So, Chris, what about you? What do you find most rewarding about working?
I think it's affecting a positive change in someone's life. It's really rewarding to be a part of that. But one of the things that we're always struck by is in speaking to an older person is actually when they've been heard. So people will say to us, "Thank you so much for listening. You're the first person I've told about my situation."
Right.
And I suppose being part of that very intimate conversation for us is really rewarding, because they're actually able to disclose. They're able to get this off their chest, maybe for the first time. It may have been happening for many, many years.
Yes.
And actually helping someone to make a change in their life and to be part of that is really rewarding.
Yes, yeah. So then they realise they do have options.
That's right, that there are choices, and helping people explore choices where they may have thought that they weren't able to make changes or that changes were too difficult or that it was going to be too disruptive to their family because it's happening in that family unit.
Yes.
And so they maybe never wanted to explore them. But, you know, I think looking at those simpler steps first and supporting people to make those steps, you know, it will make huge changes for somebody. So being part of that is a real privilege.
Definitely. Yeah. And the Elder Abuse Helpline, that's been going since when did
it's
that start?
It's March 2013. So we're now five and a bit years old.
Yes.
And we are experiencing, you know, approximately 300 phone calls per month now.
Wow.
From community members and professionals.
Yes.
About a fifth of our calls are coming from older people themselves who are experiencing abuse.
Wow.
And incrementally, that's going up by about 1% a year. It's usually that third party that lets us know something's not right for someone.
Yes.
But certainly when we do outreach, like at the recent Seniors Expo, we had so many people we connected with and so many people who came up to us and said, there's something happening for a friend of mine.
Right.
Can we call you? Yes. So that they know that the service is available and they can reach out to us.
So that recognition is
there's
really
a recognition, absolutely.
The service.
Yeah.
And so is that funded by the state government, the Elder Abuse Helpline?
Yeah, we're funded wholly by Family and Community Services.
Oh, okay.
And we're past the pilot. So we were a pilot for the first 3 years of the helpline's life.
Right.
And so our funding is through to June 2019 at this stage.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah.
So today we're talking about something that's fairly topical. Some people may have already heard about the Australian Law Reform Commission inquiry into elder abuse. And this year we also had the National Elder Abuse Conference in Sydney. And at that conference, the Federal Attorney General, Christian Porter, talked about a national plan for elder abuse that's going to be developed this year. So why do you think elder abuse is such a hot topic? Do you want to start, Chris?
I think it's finally getting the recognition it requires to, you know, change people's lives. So much like broadly domestic and family violence was 20 years ago,
yes.
It was under-recognised, under-reported. People didn't speak about it. It was happening behind closed doors and that's where it stayed.
Yes.
So now that is certainly getting an audience and often types of elder abuse fit within that space, and so they're being recognised as that and they're getting that wider audience and the attention. I think probably the 2015 state inquiry into the abuse of older people in New South Wales really helped.
Yes.
And we know certainly from our own experience from that,
yes.
We had a lot of different government agencies then responding to elder abuse as part of the recommendations the inquiry,
yes.
As well as obviously the Law Reform Commission as well and the work that they're doing to address it. So from our perspective, the more press this gets, the more agencies that are involved, whether they be at a state or a federal level, the better it is for all older people that are living in Australia. Absolutely. So you need to shine a light on the issue.
Okay. And what about you, Lee? Do you think elder abuse hot topic more than it has been in the past? Or?
Well, I'm not exactly sure why it's a hot topic now, except that, I mean, there's demographic changes that are seeing that old people are living longer.
Right.
And so the longer you live, the more chance it is that you might get some cognitive impairment.
True.
And that there's an increased, you know, like medical science is keeping people alive a lot longer. So and combined, I think, with the financial situation in relation to a generation where we always expected that each generation would do better financially than the last generation. But it would appear that this has changed and that our parents perhaps, you know, or the older people, their adult children may not actually even be as financially as well off as they are at the same age. And therefore there's more issues around the sort of sense of entitlement and I'll talk about that later
in terms of
when we talk about who the abusers are.
Let's talk about that now. So Chris, what is elder abuse and who are the abusers?
Elder abuse is an act or a repeated act or a lack of appropriate action in any relationship where there's an expectation of trust, and this causes harm or distress to an older person. So that's the World Health Organization definition that we work under. And I suppose what's most important as a takeaway from that is it's a trust relationship that's being breached. So trust relationships include any relationship with family, so that could be spouse, partners, husbands, wives, it could be children, it could be grandchildren, it could be daughters-in-law and sons-in-law. And so I suppose it's very, very broad, but if you look at trust, it could also be paid workers working with an older person, so a care provider of some kind. Could be neighbours or friends. So it's implicit trust in that relationship as opposed to someone you don't know snatching your bag, which was an example we used in the webinar. And there isn't that relationship with that person. That is a crime that has been perpetrated, but it wouldn't be considered elder abuse.
And the abusers, you were saying, is mostly family members and the statistics.
Yeah, it's 90% of our calls regarding an alleged abuser are family members. So it's mostly adult sons and daughters. So it's approximately 26% adult sons and 24% adult daughters. And many people are quite surprised to learn that females are equal in terms of alleged abusers to males, and it's the one form of domestic and family violence where they are.
And so I guess a lot of people might be surprised to hear that they are the main abusers of older people. So Lee, do you have any thoughts about what's behind this?
Yes, I think that an expression's being coined, I'm talking particular in relation to financial abuse, called inheritance impatience. And it's that, as I was referring to before, I mean, the people are living much, much longer than they did in the past. You know, like you can retire at 65 and you may be 30 years or 25, 30 years on the age pension. And they're, as I said, you know, we've got a generation now that is perhaps not doing as well as their parents did, and that they may be struggling financially, and they see their older parents sitting in a property that's, you know, that's quadrupled or more in value, and they may think, well, they start to get this sense that, well, I'm already entitled to it. And they can then be capable of doing things that they normally might not consider, as they can rationalise them and justify them to themselves in some way. And that's part of why it's, and also that those, that they're in a position to be able to, in being in a position of trust, they are able to access documents, access information, access property that others would, you know, that otherwise they wouldn't be able to. So it's a combination of the disparity perhaps in the financial situation of the adult children versus the parents, because of what's happened in the property market, and the fact that they're living longer, and the expectations and the financial, perhaps financial frustrations of the adult children can lead to temptation, I think, where they've got the opportunity and the motive, shall we say.
And the power if they've been
they've been given the power and they've been given access to documents. And the older you get, the more chance that at some point you are going to suffer some sort of cognitive impairment. You know? So you might be all right at 75, but at 90, you know, if you live as long, that, you know, at some point you're going to, you're really going to need help. And that's when you, the temptations are there.
And so Chris, well, Lee's talking about financial abuse. Is that one of the main issues that are raised with you on the helpline?
It absolutely is. And I think, you know, this, that sad reality that people have become monetized. It's, you know, if someone can justify abusing a person, then they, that person almost drops away, the personality drops away, and they become the bank, basically, bank of mum and dad. And that is all too you know, often the reality of the calls that we take.
Mm-hmm.
Financial abuse is a very often reported instance to us, as is, I mean, psychological abuse is the most common.
Right.
But people often will psychologically abuse someone to allow that financial abuse to occur. So it could be that they withhold a relationship from themselves or grandchildren if they're not given money, right, or if they're not made signatory on a will, or if they're not made a power of attorney, if they're not given money at that point in time, so actual cash money.
Yes.
All sorts of, you know, scenarios play out, but certainly we hear about neglect.
Yes.
And that could be intentional or unintentional, and particularly that is loaded with financial abuse. So if someone is managing someone else's money, they may be conserving that cash for themselves and not spending it on the services that mum or dad might require.
Such just as, give them the bare minimum.
Absolutely, even less than the bare minimum, sadly. So it could be next to nothing, so that they can actually gain either from money or property.
Yes.
So some kind of asset.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just thinking about the people that you have recently assisted in your roles, and the people who then contacted you or alerted you to their situation, and how that might have been assisted if someone had alerted you earlier. Can you think of a situation, Chris, where someone's rung the helpline and you thought, oh, I wish they'd contacted us, you know, 6 months, 12 months ago? It's kind of got to a point where it's much worse for the older person.
Yeah. We often have people that sit with the knowledge of something going on but not doing anything for fear of repercussions for themselves. So if it was a worker, perhaps it could be that they fear that they might lose their job.
Oh.
And that can be a very real demotivator for people actually reaching out and letting people know that things are happening for an older person.
Right.
If it, you know, just about anybody might be hesitant in actually, you know, putting their hand up at an earlier stage because they're not too sure. That can be another real reason why people don't speak up and speak out about abuse.
Yes.
And so there are so many different factors that would mean that people didn't do something previous to the point where we are now when we get that call.
Yeah.
But we can always work with where we are.
Yes.
So it's never too late to call us. And we would always suggest to people, if there is a concern, call in the first instance, if you can.
Yes.
But, you know, call us when you can.
Yep. And what about you, Lee? Have you sort of got...
I suppose that sometimes the situation where, for instance, somebody you may observe that there are certain problems in relation to, you know, that the person's bills don't seem to be paid or whatever. Sometimes if you know, that's the beginning of it. But if we see them and already all the assets have been dissipated, that it's too late. It can be too late to recover them.
Yes. Yeah.
Because once they've, you know, I mean, it may start off small, but then get bigger. And the sooner you get onto it, the easier it is to at least prevent some of the total loss of the person's assets.
And I think that's why Legal Aid New South Wales has this series of brochures, Legal Issues for Older People, and I think a lot of them they're good to, community workers can get a set of those and read through them. It does give some things about things you should think about before, for example, you invest in a granny flat.
Yes, definitely. I think the granny flat ones are the, but I think that's very hard for community workers necessarily to be able to pick up on because it's, you know, it's a verbal agreement between the older person and their children, and they don't get legal advice, they don't put it in writing, and then it becomes a very difficult where it's a question then, like a case I have at the moment, where they're throwing her out and she put in considerable amount of money into the property but never was on the title. But they're saying, well, it was a gift.
Yes.
And there was never any agreement between us that you would be a part owner in this property or have any rights to this property. And that can be, you know, the nature of a being a he said, she said scenario can just make it that much more difficult.
Yeah.
I guess with community workers, though, if they hear the older person telling them they're thinking about doing this,
indeed,
they
yes.
could say, oh, well, have you been
you
to
really
see a
need
lawyer
to get some
to
advice.
Get
yeah.
advice.
Why don't you talk to, I mean, they can even get, you know, a half-hour session with legal aid where we'd have an opportunity to talk them through the risks and pitfalls of such an arrangement.
Yeah. Without any sort of documentation.
Yeah.
And you're right, that is where it might be a little bit too late for, you know, an intervention. However, we would suggest to people, if we look at early intervention or prevention, to try and put things in writing. We know it's family and that you get a verbal agreement and that's okay, but consider putting things in writing. Consider getting legal help actually to make those decisions for yourself, just to keep yourself safe if something should happen, rather than assuming something bad will happen.
And and making sure it's independent legal advice, not necessarily the lawyer that the son or daughter is using.
Or the member of the family that happens to be a lawyer.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Which we hear about
that
too.
That other scenario. Yeah. So, and just in terms of elder abuse, both of you, do you think that it affects people across all communities and cultures? It's not just restricted to rich people, for example, or not rich people?
It's more the people that it does affect more often are not the rich.
Right.
It's the asset rich, cash poor person on an age pension that actually has something that somebody finds desirable and is worth a lot of money, but they don't actually have a lot of assets other than that home that they have. Because the rich are usually a lot more canny and probably have, you know, continual legal accounts and legal representation and that sort of thing. Whereas it's the person that's their only asset is their home and maybe they've got the age pension and perhaps they've got, you know, some other belongings and stuff that may be worth some money, but their prime asset is their house, and it can affect. I mean, it's also across community groups. I mean, in my experience, you know, it's been people from a lot of different national backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds. It may be that we found that at legal aid, there's been some groups, you know, non-English speaking background that have been vulnerable to issues like mortgaging their home.
Right.
And the benefits of that going to their children.
Yes.
Partly because perhaps their English isn't that great. They're not able to really comprehend or read the documents. And they may just be perhaps a little more feeling that, you know, that they're obliged to help their family, but it's not just, it's people across lots of different cultural backgrounds.
Yes.
It's this dynamic between adult children and their parents, which is universal, I think.
Is that your experience as well?
It is. Certainly it affects all communities, and I think it is, as Lee mentioned, not necessarily people who have a lot of money. It can be affecting anyone. So it might be someone who's opportunistic and sees that you've got $10 more than me and I have the ability to actually manipulate to get that money from you. So wealth is all very subjective, and, you know, it depends on what the other person who's the alleged abuser wants and needs from that person. So, you know, that's, as I said, wealth is just in the eye of the perpetrator, really. And certainly cultures. So there's cultural norms and nuances. There's intergenerational living. These are causing stresses and you know, different dynamics that we haven't really seen before much in Australia, I think.
Right.
But it is certainly happening in these cultures. And to address that, we're working on a specific program to reach culturally and linguistically diverse older people with bilingual educators actually going out to different groups. They've already got that trust built in. They can actually go out and speak to people about what their rights are and that, you know, systems in Australia can be trusted and that people can change the situation again if they choose to.
Mm.
Yeah.
So does the helpline invest a bit of quite a lot of energy into that education of communities about the law in Australia and their rights?
We touch on the law, but we don't speak specifically about the law. So that's where we refer to, you know, legal aid or legal professionals. But certainly about rights and rights being disrespected regarding the different types of abuse. So the five abuse types, we would let people know that they have rights to say what they do and don't want to have happen. So that's whether that be money taken or whether that's being shouted at, or whether that's someone touching them and they don't want to be touched, but they have the right to say no and to have that change so that they don't have to live through that.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we just did a webinar together and we were talking about the Five Steps Toolkit. So people can listen to that webinar because that'll go up on our Legal Aid New South Wales YouTube. But can you just tell us, Chris, a little bit about the Five Steps Toolkit, why you developed it and how community workers are using it?
Sure. That was certainly based on the calls that we take on the helpline and the need of community workers or frontline workers who are working with older people to recognise and respond to abuse in the community. So in community, it's very different to in residential aged care. There are more checks and balances within res care. Right. There are reporting requirements for certain types of abuse, particularly in res care. But if you're living out in the community, you're reliant really on a third party. So that's usually a community worker going in, identifying that something's not right for an older person, and then it's relying on that third party to actually get some assistance for the older person. So that's how we drafted it and put it all together. So the five steps are simple for any worker to pick up. There's a flow chart within the kit itself to actually go, well, what do I need to do? Step one, that's identifying, and then you can work your way all the way through to referring and responding at the end. And it's what are your responsibilities in your particular role? And within each of the five steps, there are tools that you can utilise. You may not have to use all of them, but there's certainly ways in which, you know, in terms of gathering information, you'd be looking for conversation starters with that older person. How do you actually approach the subject if you've got concerns about an older person? They've hinted at something, but they haven't told you something overtly. How can you actually flesh that out and get some more information? So really it was about the community worker in mind and someone who's frontline who's actually dealing with that. So that's how we developed it.
So community workers could be paid workers but also volunteers.
Absolutely.
Like Meals on Wheels. People who pop in once a day and community, drop stuff off.
Yeah, community visitor scheme. Anyone who interacts with an older person, it could be within a day centre. They also have a lot of volunteers there as well. It could be an activity group that the older person attends. So there's certainly a lot of opportunities for an older person to disclose what's been going on or for a third party to witness or suspect that something isn't right for the older person. So we speak to a lot of different workers. So it may, as you said, not be a paid worker, but it's someone who's equally important to that older person, equally important to community in terms of the work that they're doing, and equally important in terms of actually getting a response to the abuse.
But one of the things we were talking about earlier is that isolation is one of the predicators, I guess, or vulnerability that causes people to be vulnerable to abuse. So I guess there's a danger that community work, they might think, oh, another worker will pick this up. There's a paid worker that's visiting. They might pick this up, but then they might be more trusted if they're a volunteer or a neighbour or something, someone in that older person's life. So they might say things to them that they wouldn't say to a paid worker who might dash in or dash out, you know, like
they might be aware.
Relationships. So I guess it's good for everybody to, if they do have some fear, to call the helpline.
We all have a responsibility to respond to abuse, and so we know it's difficult for different people thinking that maybe it's not my role or it's not my job, but it's okay to say, and it's okay to call us if you have a suspicion or if you have a disclosure or if you've witnessed something, because we're not that reporting service, and we will help you to help the older person as that third party, but to keep you safe and comfortable and okay in doing that as well. We understand it's a process, that it's difficult for people to make that phone call, because we do get calls from volunteers. We do get calls from Meals on Wheels regularly, because they're the eyes of the community. They're seeing things, they're witnessing things.
They might be the only service,
and they may be in. It may be that they're the only other person that's in the life of the older person. So we emphasize that whilst we all have that responsibility to respond, you may be the only other person in that older person's life.
Yes.
So calling us and running the scenario past isn't going to mean that we send police in all guns blazing. It doesn't happen that way.
No, exactly.
But we'll certainly look at that, as we talked about in the webinar, the response would be the gentlest response that would affect a positive change in the older person's life.
Mm. And Lee, do you know how older people get in touch with legal aid generally when they're worried about legal issues or financial abuse?
I don't think that they do get in touch with us enough. I think that it's something where the most vulnerable are the least likely to be able to consider seeing a lawyer as a solution. That's usually not what people do. It's more they're more likely to talk to their doctor about it.
Okay, yes.
So that it will be that perhaps a third party will say, oh, okay, well, we know legal aid provides this service. Maybe we should help you make an appointment and come in and see it. So that's why I suppose it's important for us to talk to community workers and to let them know that there may be something legal aid can do to help an older person that they see is vulnerable and that and has had an issue in relation to financial or other abuse, because it's unlikely that a lot of the time that older person is going to take the initiative to make an appointment and come in and see a lawyer at legal aid.
Well, especially if they're, like you were saying earlier, the sort of people who rarely would see a lawyer.
Yeah, they're more likely to see
doctors and
health professionals.
And that's why I guess legal aid is really trying to increase our contacts with the health professions and have these health justice partnerships happening where we're locating lawyers in certain health areas.
That's right, because that's where older people are more likely to get in touch with profession. A profession is more likely to be the medical profession, but can be open. Perhaps refer the person to us or make an appointment for them or whatever's at least.
So do you want to talk a little bit about what legal aid, like what happens if someone
can get an initial? There's a number of services that legal aid provide, legal services, and the services, we have a general advice service that we provide at various branches of legal aid where anybody can make an appointment to come in and see one of our solicitors about any civil or legal issue, so anything that's not really involved with family law or criminal law. And then at that point there can be an assessment about whether the legal problem that the person has is something which legal action can be, court action can be taken, and then whether in their particular circumstances they would be able to get a lawyer to act for them, a legal aid lawyer to act for them and take the other party to court. Then the other area of service we provide is something we call minor assistance. So it's something more than advice but less than legal representation, where it may be in situations there may be, we could make a phone call on someone's behalf, we could write a letter, just find out a bit more information for them, maybe give them some contacts to support services, or possibly if legal aid can't help, there may be what we call a pro bono legal service, whereas there are lawyers that in the private sector that are prepared to give up some of their time to provide free legal representation for what they consider to be people who otherwise can't get any aren't entitled to legal aid and can't afford to pay for their own legal representation.
Right. So, but people can get that initial advice, just make an appointment.
Make an appointment, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's a number of other legal services available to help people, like Seniors Rights Service. They do legal advice over the phone.
They do, yes, and I think they do minor assistance and some advocacy as well.
Yes. So there's a few options there. And just in terms of the helpline, Chris, is there things that the helpline can't help with that people need to be aware of?
There are a few areas that we can't help with. We're not our reporting line. So if someone calls us, they're not reporting abuse to us. Mm. We have a discussion regarding the concerns. We're also not an investigative body. So we don't go out to an older person's home and see how their living situations are. That said, though, we'll try and connect people to services that can.
Yes.
So if that's appropriate.
Yes. Yeah.
And then also in terms of residential aged care, if there's abuse being perpetrated in res care and it's being perpetrated by another resident or by a staff member, depending on who calls us.
Yes.
If it's a staff member that calls us, we would put them in touch with the health mandatory reporting line for physical and sexual assault.
Right.
But if it's a member of the community who calls us and things aren't right for them, we would suggest they'd obviously speak to the res care manager, and then they can also call the Aged Care Complaints Commissioner, which is a federal agency,
right,
which investigates reports of mistreatment within res care of, okay, all types as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So who are the people who call the helpline then mostly?
It's mostly community and professionals. We get broadly community could be family members that are concerned.
Right.
Usually we get another adult son or daughter calling us about their sibling who they feel is an abuse perpetrator.
Right.
And so we talk through them various steps about how to, you know, support the older person and take the next step to improve their life. For professionals, it could be a matter of working as a virtual colleague, modelling conversations, working out a plan of action, so things that they may have already thought to do or maybe hadn't thought to do, so we try and work out what could they do to support that older person that they're working with.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's pretty much 50-50 in terms of our calls, but 20% of our calls are coming from older people directly who are experiencing abuse.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So they're being proactive.
Looking
at their options.
But it usually is a third party that ends up calling us. So it usually is another service, or it will be a family member who's who's concerned about the situation for their mum or dad or grandparents.
Mm.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking, Lee, that we haven't really talked about capacity at all yet in our conversation today.
Yes, yeah.
Well, so because I think that's important that community workers like are aware of that capacity is an issue both with lawyers and I guess the helpline in thinking about strategies. So do you want to talk a little bit, Lee, about capacity in the legal
briefly context? It, you know, capacity in the legal sense is it really is talking about a person's ability to make decisions that are informed decisions, that they understand the implications of the decisions, the choices they're making, and they can weigh those up. And they can communicate those decisions.
Mm.
And so the law assumes that all adults have capacity to make decisions until proven otherwise. But of course, we can lose our capacity through illness or injury. And we do need to make a distinction between levels of decision making. So say, for example, financial decision making. You may be able to, even if you've got, say, a diagnosis of dementia or it's early onset dementia, you still might be able to make some decisions, but less complex. But if it's more complex decisions about finances and shares and investments, that may be something you don't have the capacity to do. So it is something that depends on the decision that at hand. But generally, it's going to be a question of how you respond will depend on whether the person has capacity or not. Because if you do have capacity, that the adult, you're an adult, you can make decisions. Sometimes other people wouldn't agree with them. You can make decisions, say, for example, where you choose to stay in an abusive relationship because you have reasons such as you want to keep that relationship. You don't, you know, other matters like that. That is something that essentially you have to respect the older person's right to make a decision, even if it's not one that you think is in their best interests. However, it changes when the person does not have the capacity, is in unable to make those decisions. It's then about, well, does someone need to step in and be their decision maker? And if so, who will that be?
Yes.
And or there may be decision makers that they already have in their lives that you may observe as being people that are abusing that position, And those sorts of issues can end up being decided by the guardianship division of the New South Wales Civil and Administrative Tribunal.
Yes.
And who is finally the arbiter about whether somebody, A, lacks capacity, needs a decision maker, and ultimately who that decision maker will be.
Mm. So, Chris, the people at the helpline can help people who call them about this issue as well, with capacity and what the process is if they do have concerns about that decision maker that
absolutely
might be abusing their powers.
I would second everything that Lee just said. And in terms of a response that we might offer, it would be very different based on someone's capacity to make decisions for themselves. So, of course, if depending on the scenario, we would suggest maybe could we speak with the older person directly if we're not talking to them, so we can discuss what they would actually like to do or not do about a certain situation. But certainly to the caller we have, we would offer certain suggestions. If there isn't capacity, and then we would look at, is there a substitute decision maker that's been appointed either in terms of guardianship or financially, so a power of attorney or a financial manager. And if that person is the abuser, then looking at instances where you could actually appeal that through the New South Wales Civil and Administrative Tribunal, but maybe looking for some legal support before you do this. So it could be calling Law Access to get in touch with Legal Aid to ask questions about that from a legal specialist.
So you work closely together then
we
in
do.
That regard?
That's right. So we're a generalist service, we're a referral service, and we work very closely with Legal Aid and other services to support older people in the community.
Yes.
And being generalists, we know a little bit about a whole lot of different areas.
Yes.
And so when it comes to a legal matter, we don't give legal advice because we're not lawyers.
Yes.
And so we would refer to Legal Aid.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah. So this podcast, as we've said, is for community workers on the go. So I guess our final thing to talk about is, what key message would you like to give community workers from our conversation today on how they can recognise and respond to the abuse of older people? So, Lee, do you have a key message?
I think it's just about being really observant and being able to interact with the older person in a way that doesn't frighten them off, but is able to elicit some information so that you can make a bit of a judgment about what's actually happening.
So using that toolkit, step one, and types of questions you can use to have those conversations. And Chris, do you have a final key message?
A takeaway would be, if you suspect something is happening for someone, if you haven't witnessed it, firsthand, but someone is disclosing something to you, or that just doesn't feel like something is right for a person's living conditions or with a relationship with a family member or friend, say something. So rather than keeping it to yourself, it's okay to call us to discuss anonymously. You don't have to give us your name.
Okay.
We can run the scenario with you, so we can actually look at how we can help that older person. But even if you just sort of think something's a little bit off, it's okay to call.
With
a suspicion,
right.
Please call us. So we're there to support people.
Well, that's fantastic. Yeah, we're lucky in New South Wales. Is there elder abuse helplines across Australia? Or?
There are versions of helplines. So some services, like Victoria, I can think they have a seniors' rights service, much like we also have here. So it's legal and advocacy. Queensland has a helpline, much like us. And every state and territory has something that's similar to a helpline. If it doesn't work directly like a helpline model like we do, there is certainly a service that older people can reach out to within that state or territory.
And I guess the same with Legal Aid. We have Legal Aid is replicated in all the different states and territories. So if people listening to this podcast have family members interstate, there are other services get in contact with. I guess if they call the helpline.
I was going to say, if they call us, we've got all the
numbers.
We've got a pin board that's got those numbers on it, so we can actually give those numbers to people that they can make contact. Yeah.
And I think all the different legal aids have their websites, but Law Access, I'm sure, would have phone numbers for interstate agencies as well. So thank you, Lee and Chris, for coming in today and sharing your knowledge with community workers on the go who are listening to this podcast. We're going to say goodbye now, and we look forward to welcoming you to our next podcast.
for tuning in today. If you're enjoying Law for Community Workers on the Go, make sure to spread the word. And if you have any feedback or even topic suggestions, please get in touch with us via email. Our address is cle@legalaid.newsouthwales.gov.au. We'd love to hear from you. So until next time, thanks again from the CLE branch here at Legal Aid New South Wales.